Good morning, everyone. It's good to see you today. This being the middle of the summer, the rain outside, I thought maybe some people would think of other places to go, but you're all here. It's wonderful. I don't know whether you had an opportunity to hear it, but our pastor prayed the opening invocation prayer yesterday at Loudon Raceway. Our man up there, and he did a great job. He prayed a great, great prayer. Now, when someone says that, you're supposed to respond and say, "How great was it?" So I'll say, he prayed a great, great prayer. How was it? Well, I heard this morning that 110,000 people came to hear it, and but it was a good prayer. I heard it myself, and I appreciate the content. You did a great job. The subject this summer has been the life of Joseph. And if I were personally to try to think through the Bible, who are the women and the men who are my greatest personal heroes, I think Joseph would be in the top three or four. And he's very relevant even in our day. No matter where you are politically, you are very much aware these days that there's a great question of what is leadership mean and who are the people who are qualified to lead? And how do we make decisions as we assess various people at varying levels of government and business and in other places? How do we look at them? And that's really behind the whole story of Joseph. Here is this young man who grows up in a family that's well known at that time, the family of Jacob. And early in his life, he says things and does things that gain some antipathy, some hostility from his other 10 or 11 brothers. Before long, he in effect is kicked out of the family when his brothers arrest him, throw him down a pit, sell him as a slave to people in Egypt. And then his story begins to ascend. He's really a slave, but he ends up running the businesses of the person to whom he's enslaved until he can do no wrong, it seems. And the Bible says, the Lord's strong hand was upon him. And then he's falsely accused of rape, and he's sent to jail. And for a good long time, he's in prison on this false charge. But he's the kind of person who, even in prison, begins to ascend until now he's in charge of the jail. And his reputation begins to spill out. And one day, the Pharaoh of Egypt has had a series of very strange, mysterious dreams. He needs somebody to come and interpret what it's been for him to sleep at night and dream these dreams. And someone says, the man you want to talk to is Joseph. So Joseph is called to the palace of the Pharaoh. And the Pharaoh says to him, this is part of my dream. I'd like for you to tell me what it means. And it's Joseph who tells the Pharaoh that his country is going to face some severe economic downturns in the near future. In fact, Joseph says, you're going to have seven powerful, high-octane years where the economy is just going to explode and everybody's going to gain from it. But then it's going to be followed by seven other years where everything is going to fall apart and people are going to starve to death if something isn't done. And Pharaoh says, where can we find a person who could be trusted with all of the assets of our country to solve this problem and to treat people with justice and fairness? How could we find such a man? And before long, the conclusion is, Joseph's the guy. And so Joseph finds himself going from a little boy in a desert family to a person who's an assistant to a business tycoon, to a jail where he's running the prison, and now he's basically in charge of the family when things come along. Maybe you've heard, like I've heard 1,000 times lately, the TV commercial for Capital One, which always ends with this question: what's in your wallet? And preacher that I sometimes am, I keep listening to that and saying, there's got to be a sermon illustration in that. And that caused me one day, in anticipation of this morning, to change the question a little bit and use it as a title for these moments of thinking. Not what's in your wallet, but what's in your memory? Because that's a big question that we find in the story of Joseph this Sunday morning. What's in your memory? A lot of people don't think about it, but God has built into each of us as human beings, among other things, two very powerful, can I call them, tools. One is the tool of imagination. It's the ability for people like you and me, in our minds, to look ahead to possibilities in the coming years, to picture ourselves as if we were players on a stage or in a movie, to picture ourselves doing this kind of job, living in this kind of place, being this kind of a success. And we spend time just thinking about all the possibilities, especially when we're young. Young people often have great imaginations, and they think of all the potential scenarios of what might happen if they did this or that. I remember when I first met my wife, Gail, 57 years ago. My imagination ran wild with the possibilities that would be before me if she would be willing to share life with me. And all the way down through life, because I tend to be an artistic, poetic person, my imagination is always at 90 miles an hour thinking about possibilities and what this would do and what that would do. Every one of us, to one extent or another, has an imagination to look into the future. But just as interesting is that we all have memories. If the imagination takes me forward, the memory takes me backwards. When I'm young, my memory is very short. But when you reach my age, which is a little over 49, when you reach my age and the age of a few of the rest of you, now we have long memories. We keep scrapbooks and all kinds of material to remind us, but most of all, we consult this library deep in our minds, and we think about the good old days when we were teenagers, and then we were in our 20s and 40s, and some of us can go up into our 70s and 80s. The thing about that memory is that it's always active. It's always speaking up from the past into the present. If we thought about it for very long, we would be amazed at how much of our present behavior and our attitude is controlled by elements of thought and memory from the past. And to some extent, that's what the story is that Joseph all about. There is a great Christian writer by the name of Frederick Buechner who some years ago wrote this piece of poetry. Think about this. He writes, "Every person we have ever known, every place we have ever seen, everything that has ever happened to us, it all lives and breathes deep within us somewhere." Now, if you muse upon that piece of poetry, those four or five lines for a while, it will blow your mind. Because I think Buechner is speaking truthfully here, that our memories carry deep within us a memory of all the incidents that have happened all the way through our lives. And sometimes those memories come back and they fill us with confidence and joy and appreciation. But some of us have memories that when we go backwards and we recall events and relationships and experiences, it can destroy us for a while, create moods, resurrect anger, all sorts of possibilities when a memory has gone bad. And that's very much at the center of the story of Joseph. I'd like for a moment to go back to the Bible in Genesis chapter 41, 42, and read for all of us some snippets of the story as we've come up to this point in the life of Joseph. Listen to these words. "Egypt's 7 good years came to an end, and the 7 years of famine that Joseph had predicted, they arrived. All countries experienced famine. Egypt was the only country, thanks to Joseph, that had bread. The people called out in distress to Pharaoh, calling for bread. He told the Egyptians, 'Go to Joseph.'" What an interesting phrase. Go to Joseph. He's the most trustworthy, the most character-filled man in our land. Whatever he does, you do what he tells you to do. Why? Because the man has character. As the famine got worse all over the country, Joseph opened the storehouses. He sold emergency supplies to the Egyptians. The famine was very bad, and soon the whole world was coming to buy supplies from Joseph. The famine was bad all over. When Jacob, that's Joseph's father living many, many miles away, when Jacob learned that there was food in Egypt, he said to his sons, he had had 12 sons, now he had 11, or that's what he assumed, he thought one was dead. When Jacob heard that there was food in Egypt, he said to these sons, "Why are you sitting around here and looking at one another?" Can you imagine a father saying that to sons? "I've heard that there's food in Egypt. Go down there and buy some so that we can survive and not starve to death." 10 of Joseph's brothers, remember there were 12, but now there are 10, went down to Egypt to get food. Jacob, the old father, didn't send Joseph's brother Benjamin with them. He was afraid that something bad might happen to him. Let me stop for just a second. Why is Jacob afraid? First of all, because Benjamin is now his favorite son. It had been Joseph, but he thinks Joseph's dead. So now Benjamin is the best of them all. And Jacob is living in the past. His memory is beginning to operate at this point. The last time he sent his sons off, years before, Joseph had never returned. And Jacob had lost his best son. And now, in this particular moment, his memory goes into operation. I lost Joseph the last time the brothers went off. I don't want to lose Benjamin. So he says to the 10 brothers, "Go off and get the food, but Benjamin stays with me." So Jacob's sons joined everyone else that was going to Egypt to buy food, and for Canaan was hard by failure. So there's the story. And it's a story that describes three kinds of people, and here's a term I've made up for the morning, who reach what I'd like to call this morning a point of consequence. For 20 years, this family has been existing, 20 years more or less, have been existing under a certain series of understandings. Joseph is gone. The young brothers are now in charge. Jacob is waiting to die. And now comes a moment that triggers all of those people to have a change in life. There's a consequence settling in. I call it the point of consequence. That idea is important to me as a man my age, because when I look back across the years, and I think many of you can do this too, you begin to remember there were certain events in the past that were points of consequence. They don't come very often, but every once in a while, after a few years of living in one way or the other, making choices, working with various kinds of people, there comes a moment where everything reaches ahead and you say to yourself, this has been a most successful moment. Or it's been a disaster. I've got to change. I've got to do something differently. Well, that's what's happening here. Jacob, the father, the sons who have to go for food, and off in Egypt, Joseph, are all reaching a point of consequence where something has to change. So let me talk about those three for just a moment or two, and with the hope that you might kind of glom onto my words and do what I'm trying to do when I ask myself the question, what difference does this story make to the person I am today, a biblical person, a follower of Jesus? How does this story speak it into my life? Well, the first person who comes along here is Jacob. Jacob's been around who knows for how many years. Take my word for it, he is an old, old man. And if you go back into the earlier chapters of the book of Genesis and you read those chapters that tell the story of the life and the growth of Jacob, you discover this man has done a lot of living. He's a man who's looked face to face with evil. He's a man who's known some blessed moments where he drew nearer to God. But his life has been very up and down. There's not much about Jacob that one would really admire. There's not much about him that would make you really want to know him, except that he's grown this large family of various kinds of people of character that are both good and bad. And now he's reaching his old age. And he's not finishing well. He's a man who's afraid. He's a man who's bitter. He's a man who's coming face to face with the fact that he's going to die. And when he dies, who will take over the family business? Who will be the new father figure? He's smart enough to know that 10 of the sons that he's raised are moral and spiritual disasters. They don't seem to be hardworking. They have to be pushed and shoved into whatever they do. And when they do things wrong, they try to cover up the consequences. So Jacob is not facing the latter years of his life with much to be happy about. I've met people like Jacob. Over the years that I had the privilege of being a pastor to a few congregations, there were always those women and men around the congregation as they grew into their last years of life. They were not pretty years. There was a lot of work left undone. There were a lot of failures. And as they reach into their 60s and their 70s and their 80s, their lives are packed with regret and bitterness and anger. If you're a pastor and you're asked to preside at the funeral of one of those people, you spend a day or two before the service trying to figure out, what can I say about this person that won't be offensive to their family, that somehow will resolve us and give other people hope that there are different ways and different choices? So I feel that I've met Jacob. I feel like I understand a little bit about how this thinks. Yes, there are some good moments in his life you can go back to, but yes, there are also moments where he's just made a mess out of everything. And now the famine comes. What will Jacob do when his family is threatened, when the whole world is starving to death? He doesn't know that his favorite son, who could have resolved all this, is still alive. He thinks he's dead. So Jacob says to his son, "For me, nothing is left. One of these days, they're going to put me," well, listen to the words are on the screen, "if something bad happens to Benjamin on the road, you'll put my gray, sorrowing head in the grave." That's Jacob. That's the way he's thinking. He's just wrapped in pessimism and the feeling that it's all going to go wrong. Now, I said a few moments ago that as a pastor, I've met people like Jacob. I've had the responsibility of trying to say something about the end of those people's lives. But now here we are in this sanctuary. And each of us needs to ask whether we are young or old. How much of Jacob is in us? What's the potential as life goes on that we might make choices, that we might step out of the way of godly and biblical character, that we might become unfaithful people in one way or the other? And then we come to those last years and we feel like we have nothing to show for it. That, by the way, is one of the reasons that people might come to a place like this every week, every seventh day. Because we want to check ourselves. We want to go deep within as the Spirit of God touches our lives. We want to ask ourselves each Sunday morning, what have the last 7 days been like? Did I become more like a Jacob, or did I become more like somebody else that shows godly character and depth? Every week in a worship service, there is an opportunity to check myself, where I am in relationship to a person like Jacob. Now, the second group of players in this story, after you get past Jacob, are the 10 brothers. I've already told a little bit of their story, and those of you who did Sunday school very regularly will remember that when Joseph was a small boy, his father had kind of pointed him out as the favorite son and given him this coat that we call the coat of many colors. What's going on here is that Jacob, years before, had named Joseph to be, even though he was number 11 or 12 on the family totem pole, Jacob had promoted him up to be number one. When the day came that Jacob was to die, it would be Joseph who would step in to run the family. And please understand, families in those days are not like families today. A family was a big extended group of people, maybe sometimes numbering in the hundreds. And Jacob at this point would be the head of that family. And that family was a business family. It was all together for economic reasons. That's why it was very important to know who was marrying into your family. Were they an asset to the business or were they not? The family becomes a defense department. These are the people who protect each other if dangerous people come into the neighborhood. And of course, the family, in Jacob's sense, is one that's been special recognized by God. So the leader of this family, should Jacob die, is a very, very important selection. And Joseph, with that coat of colors, a teenage boy, was designated by his father to be the heir apparent of this whole family. That means that 10 other brothers older have been skipped over. How would you handle it if you were first in a family and suddenly your father or your mother in their aging years came to you and said, oh, we're going to put the family estate in child number 5? You know, would you have any problem with that? So Joseph was the designated heir of the family, the firstborn son in terms of the father's designation. But now he's gone. The brothers, out of jealousy, have thrown him into a pit and then sold him into slavery. He's gone. He's disappeared. And for the next 20 years, I'm guessing at the number, those brothers have to live with what they've done. When they get to Egypt looking for the food, they begin to realize that the man who's in charge of the food is the brother they thought had disappeared. They'd not heard a word from him for 20 years. No Facebook, no Twitter. Thank God. And now they're looking at Joseph Square and realizing he's around. And what's their reaction? Joseph's going to kill us. The first chance he gets, he's going to wreak vengeance upon us. If you go back in the story of those brothers in earlier chapters, you'll discover how capable they are of terrible violence. They are corrupt, they are immoral, they are violent. And now they have to face the consequence of what they did with their younger brother Joseph. And they start saying to each other, we're going to pay for what we did. He's going to kill us. The first chance he gets, we're gone. So that's the kind of men that those brothers are. They understand violence and they understand vengeance when they see it, and they are scared to death. More than a few of us in this room look back across the years and we ask the question, what's in my memory? And maybe we look at some event or some betrayal or some tragedy way back there, and we can't forget it. It hangs on our backs like a piece of baggage. And the guilt is there over and over again as we are reminded of things in our past we wish would never have happened. What do those brothers need? They need someone to come into their lives and talk about the mercy and the grace of God. They need for someone to come along and tell them, you don't have to live in the past with all your mistakes and your failures and your sins. There's a place in history called the cross. And when one makes their way to the cross and opens their lives up, the Bible calls it repentance. There are other words in modern times that are just as good. But when we come to the cross, and we open up the interior of our lives and we make visible the things for which we're responsible in the past, there's a different way to handle this than just to be afraid. So you have the father living at home, terrified about the consequences of old age and that his favorite sons are gone. You have the brothers making their way to Egypt, hopeful to buy food, and we'll see more of that later on. Not knowing what's going to happen to them when they realize that the person they have to deal with was the brother that they tried to kill. Which leads us to the third player in this story, and that's Joseph himself. When Joseph comes to an understanding, the brothers having arrived in Egypt, and he realizes he's looking at his brothers for the first time in, again, about 20 years. How does Joseph handle that? Does he simply say, oh, you're forgiven, I'm not going to hold this against you? Was it hard for Joseph to face those brothers? You and I better believe it. Three or four times we're told in the next chapters that as Joseph approached his brothers and he talked with them and he renewed the relationship they'd had, Joseph would suddenly disappear. What for? To weep. Not just a few tears, but to weep violently, to sob. At one point, we're told in the Bible that he wept so loudly they could hear him several blocks down the street. What's going on here? To use modern words, Joseph has struggled for 20 years, I believe, with abandonment issues. We can't underestimate what it must have done to this teenage boy when his own flesh and blood, when his brothers tore him away from his family and sentenced him, they thought, to death. How would you feel if your whole family, give or take one or two as an exception, how would you feel if your family kicked you out the door and wasn't interested in never seeing you again and hoped you were dead? Joseph had to live with that for 20 years. And I don't think living with that was as easy as some people might think absentmindedly. No, if you dig into it and you think through it clearly, as competent as Joseph was, as full of deep character as he was, I would suggest to you that Joseph spent a lot of time in those years suffering. How's my old father doing? How is Benjamin? Oh, I can remember the great foods we used to have when we ate together as a family. I can remember the times when I had responsibility and my father was so pleased with the way I handled myself. And now it's all gone. Wherever I go personally, I hear about abandonment issues. I hear from men, I hear from women. Gail and I hear from couples about things in the memory that happened 15, 20, 30 years ago. The pain that comes about because of a divorce, a lost loved one, a breakup in a relationship, a humiliation of one kind or another. And it just, as Buechner says in that poem, it just hangs within us. So how does Joseph handle this abandonment issue when he comes up close to his brothers? Answer, as we're going to see in the coming weeks, he learns how to forgive. Almost every one of us has had a point of consequence sooner or later in life where we had to make a choice to forgive somebody. Or it was the other way around. We were at a moment where someone needed to forgive us. And that's part of the beauty of the story of Joseph himself. We've had all these previous chapters that we've heard about week after week, about Joseph, the competent leader, Joseph, the faithful leader of this, that, and the other thing, Joseph, the dependable person. And those are thrilling stories. They're almost like reading a business management manual. But I have a sneaking suspicion that the one who wrote this story was less interested in those chapters than he was in the next chapters, where Joseph has to struggle with the giving of mercy and grace to brothers who had wanted him to die. And I'm going to dare to say, even this morning, as you and I are together in this room, this just could be one of the greatest single issues that more than a few of us face from week to week. Do we need to be forgiven? Do we need to forgive? A couple weeks ago, Gail and I took an evening off and we went over to the Red River Theater and we saw this film, Welcome to My Neighborhood, about Mr. Rogers. If you haven't gone, get there as fast as you can and bring a box of tissue. Many of us remember Mr. Rogers because our children watched him over the years in television. A few of us are young enough that we watched him ourselves when we were small. Mr. Rogers was quite a man. And in one of the books written about him, there is this story, which I find very touching. A lot of people don't know that Mr. Rogers intended to be a pastor. And he went off to seminary, and he got his degree in theology, and it was toward the end of that time that he decided that he really wanted to have a ministry to children via television, and thus the Mr. Rogers series that we all know so well. He tells about his seminary days and about one professor who was his favorite, a man by the name of Dr. William Orr at Princeton Theological Seminary. And when Dr. Orr became an old man, he began to settle into a little bit of dementia. He had to be institutionalized, if that's the word. And every Sunday afternoon, Mr. Rogers and his wife would go and pay this professor a visit. They loved him that much. And along during the visit each Sunday afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. Rogers would sing some hymns to Dr. Orr. And Dr. Orr would pick up the hymn and sing with them. Now let me read to you what I have here. One day they sang the hymn, "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God," Martin Luther's great hymn. And when they finished, Mr. Rogers said to his professor, "Dr. Orr, we just sang this hymn, and I've got to ask you about a part of it. You know where it says, 'The prince of darkness grim, we tremble not for him, for lo, his doom is sure. One little word shall fell him.' Dr. Orr, what is the one thing that would wipe out evil?" And Dr. Orr said, "Evil simply disintegrates in the presence of forgiveness. When you look with accusing eyes at your neighbor, or your spouse, or your coworker, or your father, that is what evil would want. Because the more the accuser can spread the accusing spirit, the greater evil spreads. On the other hand, if you can look with the eyes of the Savior on your neighbor, those are the eyes of Jesus." And Mr. Rogers said, "I've never forgotten that. I've never forgotten that." And I would suggest to you that that was the message in one way or the other that Joseph had to hear. How do you forgive those who hate you, who accuse you, who want you dead? And if we can find a way to forgive each other in such moments, or to ask for forgiveness from those who need to give it to us, then we might find more of us being the kind of man or woman that Joseph was. We need to pray. Father, thank you for the Bible that gives us such rich stories. Thank you for a Bible that tells us about godly women and godly men who learn so much, sometimes the difficult way, and help us to learn too. I'm quite sure, Lord, that in this congregation, there may be a few, or maybe many more, who need to decide whether they're like Jacob, or like the brothers, or like Joseph was becoming. Help us, Lord, to perceive which we are. Amen.